You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his most recent book, Magnetic City, A Walking Companion to New York, Justin Davidson, who's been New York Magazine's architecture critic for the past 10 years, examines the city's history through architecture as he walks through seven neighborhoods and then meditates on the peculiarities of life in the Big Apple. He writes that between 2002 and 2013, the city changed its skin and acquired a fresh glow. I spoke with Justin Davidson this past May, and we're replaying that interview for you now. I began by quoting something from his book, "Since 2002, the city has become cleaner, lighter, and shinier." And I asked why he would start the book off in the years following the 9/11 attacks.
Well, the city made an amazing recovery from the 9/11 attacks, and it really propelled a whole new era of development. Yeah.
And what's caused those changes? We're replacing old stone and brick buildings with glass towers?
A lot of it. A lot of the old stone and brick buildings have also been cleaned and restored, and you know, it's part of the way the city has changed.
And then the skyline has changed. We have what you call those anorexic supermodel buildings, others called the sliver buildings. Everyone I know hates them. Do you see them as a positive development?
I see them as not a terribly negative development. I think that there are going to be, all told, relatively few of them. By definition, I mean, they have so few apartments in them. You just can't create a whole skyline and a whole city out of those, but they do definitely, you know, change the way the skyline registers.
Many people worried that the 9/11 attacks would cause people to leave the city, but 15 years later, it seems it's more crowded than ever.
It doesn't just seem that way. It is. Population is heading towards 9 million, slowly but steadily.
Was that city policy that's encouraged that?
Well, certainly, I think city policy has encouraged that and has also made a point of attracting tourists. So if it feels like there are more tourists on the streets up until now, we'll see what happens now that we have a national policy of hostility towards visitors. But, you know, so far that number has continued to grow, partly as a function of policy and partly, I think, just for economic reasons and the inherent attractions of the city.
Began with Mayor Bloomberg or even earlier?
Well, certainly, if you look back to 2000, the year before the 9/11 attacks, the number of visitors to the city hovered around 30 million, which was a lot and had been going up. It's now close to 60 million, I think.
Is that why you're calling it a magnetic city?
I think...
Because it's also been a magnet for people who live in other parts of the country.
Yeah, I think that New York has always been and is even more now a city that exerts a real magnetic pull on people of all different kinds coming from all different places and for all different reasons. There are, affluent tourists who will spend $400, $1,000 a night for a hotel room, but there are also immigrants who come with nothing, and that has continued to be true, and that is really the lifeblood of the city. But also people who haven't been here or who really only know it from television. I think it has a mythic presence in the lives of people all over the world.
But it also has attracted people in the arts, for example. I once had an art teacher who said, the further you live from Times Square, the less likely you are to be an important artist. It was kind of a silly remark, but we all understood what he was saying.
I think that one of the things that we've discovered about New York is how many people feel like they have to be here, and even though they have to make a lot of sacrifices to be here in a lot of different businesses. So people will do a lot. They will stand a lot in order to be close to other people in their businesses and their worlds and in New York.
You've divided your book into seven walking tours: the Financial District, the World Trade Center, the Seaport, Governor's Island, and the Brooklyn Waterfront, West Chelsea and the High Line, 42nd Street, the Upper West Side, and Sugar Hill and the South Bronx. How did you choose those particular areas out of the city's hundreds of neighborhoods, some of which others would have thought would have been better choices?
Well, certainly there are more things not in this book than are in this book.
Like Queens is not in this book. Staten like Island is in this book. Most
exactly,
of Brooklyn.
Right. And I hope if the book is very successful, we'll do another edition and expand it. But in terms of how I picked, I felt the need to... The criteria were that I had to be able to write something that was about the long-term development of the area, and I had to be able to walk through it or move through it in a kind of logical sequence. In one case, it's by bike. Another one involves a ferry, but that I didn't want to just be connecting disparate areas. And I also wanted to be able to tell a story that evolved over time.
And one of your themes is how neighborhoods are constantly being transformed, especially former manufacturing and shipping districts being turned into residential enclaves or parkland. Do you think those transformations are generally a positive thing?
I think transformation in general is by and large, a positive thing. It's a source of New York's energy. I think that what New York has done, and I try to really get into this in the book, is not transform blindly. You know, always be able to transform with a sense of what you're transforming from as well as what you're transforming to. And I think if you look at the city as a whole, it's done a good job over many years of balancing the sort of pull of nostalgia, the pull of history, and the pull of sort of forward-looking economic development.
But there's been a loss of a lot of manufacturing jobs all throughout the city, and that indicates that people are less likely to work close to home and at different kinds of jobs.
Well, the city has always had to deal with changes that went beyond what people wanted or what the policy was. The loss of manufacturing jobs was, you know, we talk about the loss of manufacturing jobs in Rust Belt towns today and, you know, rural Pennsylvania and Indiana and so on. But
except New York didn't vote for Donald Trump.
Well, but it went through a massive deindustrialization process years before those areas were dealing with the same issues. At the end of World War II in the early 50s, this was the largest manufacturing center in the country. It had the busiest port. And all of that went away very quickly and very traumatically. The amazing thing about New York was that it was able to return from that and not just return, not just limp back, but really sort of reinvent itself as a different kind of city.
My guest is Justin Davidson, whose book, Magnetic City, A Walking Companion to New York, is published by Spiegel and Grau. You begin your tour with the financial district because I'm assuming because that's where the city's development began and most of our oldest buildings are located.
Yes, but also because, as I said, you know, each walk tells a story, and so each walk has to be sort of connected chronologically as well as geographically, but also have a thematic through line. And there I thought that the best way to start telling the story of New York is to tell the story of money and how money shaped it. And that's really where that began.
And you write that from its earliest days of the city's history, how much money you make has mattered more than who you are. Is that reflected in the architecture of that district?
It was always reflected in the architecture from the very early days of New Amsterdam. I mean, if you look at the earliest map of New Amsterdam, which is called the Castello Plan, you can see the way everything crowds around the one pier that existed then, because that was where all the ships came in, and that was where the money was to be made. And the whole geography of the city has always reflected the pathways of money. And it's hard, you can't understand the city's development without understanding the economic aspect.
And you single out the Customs House designed by Cass Gilbert, which you call a Beaux-Arts temple to taxation. What makes that building so unusual?
Well, before the income tax in the early years of the 20th century, the federal government got most of its money from customs, from tariffs. And most of that money was collected in Manhattan. And so that building was created basically as the representation of the grandeur to which the nation aspired and was fueled by the money that came through the Port of New York and through that building. And so to me, it's a real civic monument, which, you know, on the one hand is just kind of a place for bureaucrats to, you know, collect their taxes. But on the other hand, really represents the aspirations of a city, which, you know, in the context of the city at that time, it was an even more huge and imposing building than it is today.
And Cass Gilbert, also designed the Woolworth Building, which has all such a special significance for American business.
Yes.
And it happens to be one of the most beautiful buildings in the world.
Yes. And it is a beautiful building. One of the things is, I mean, it was built for, you know, Woolworth, of the Woolworth chain, the Woolworth store. It was paid for entirely by one fortune without cobbling together all the different kinds of loans and subsidies and tax breaks that all kinds of buildings need today. And it's interesting because when Cass Gilbert talks about building skyscrapers, even though he really built this amazing work of art, he talks about it almost exclusively as a function of money. What makes sense financially? And that was a building that to him made sense financially.
You move on to a tour that you call Liquid City, the Seaport, Governor's Island, and the Brooklyn Waterfront. This is the biggest spread of area because you have to take a ferry to Governor's Island. Wasn't New York's harbor the original reason that the city even rose to economic importance?
Absolutely. It was. It has a, it's a deep water harbor. It was rich in oysters. It was calm. It was accessible by river, which meant that you could, you know, sail up to Albany, up the Hudson. Absolutely. We don't think, or we didn't until recently, think of New Yorkers tend to forget that they live in a maritime city. And sometimes you can smell it, you know, the way the wind changes and you can feel this smell of the sea air or the saltiness or even the Caribbean wind come in.
My brother tried to remind people of that with a book that he wrote.
He wrote a wonderful book. Philip Lopate wrote a wonderful book about being on the walking around the waterfront. And I drew a lot of inspiration from that. And the degree to which we've repurposed the waterfront for all different kinds of living is part of the whole miracle of New York in my mind.
You write about Coenties Slip as part of the financial district rather than the waterfront. How did that become a center for artist studios in the 1950s?
Well, you know, so the waterfront and the financial district, of course, overlapped because money flowed into New York from the water. Because it was a mercantile city. So in the 50s, when that area was already starting to decline, and as a shipping area, there was a lot of abandoned real estate. And what happens when you abandon real estate or when it starts to lose value is artists come in. And so there was a group of artists, including Robert Indiana, who lived in one or two buildings along Coenties Slip. And then there is a wonderful Hans Nemeth photograph of a group of them on the roof, and you can see the whole skyline of New York, and they're just hanging out on the roof of this, you know, building in what is going to be this high-rise area.
And all of these areas eventually wind up being turned into either upscale residential areas or parks. We have that with a number of all the piers alongside Manhattan and much of Brooklyn.
Well, with the waterfront, I think that really is a matter of policy. I think it was clear, and this is true in cities all over the world, because as the shipping went away, because it went to larger outside of city centers because of containerization, because you needed a place to stack containers, the old ports in Amsterdam, in Rotterdam, in Barcelona, and in Hong Kong, and in New York, were basically abandoned. And so you had all of this waterfront land, and much of it polluted. And you really needed public investment to figure out what to do with it and how to pay for it. And so the reclamation of the waterfront, to me, is one of the great stories, sort of urban stories, of the last 20, 30 years.
I'm speaking with Justin Davidson, who's book, Magnetic City, A Walking Companion to New York, is published by Spiegel & Grau. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with a rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Justin Davidson this past May about his book, Magnetic City, A Walking Companion to New York,
which is published by Spiegel & Grau. We spoke about his walking tour of the waterfront and Governor's Island, which has been transformed in recent years from a Coast Guard station to a summer recreation paradise. I asked him if he thought the park had been a success.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a wonderful thing. And it's amazing to see people come, take it over. You know, 20 years ago, I think, or it was just not a place that people even were aware of its existence. And they started to come before it was even fixed up. And
families.
Families, people from all over. And, you know, you get these incredible views of Lower Manhattan. It's the best view anywhere of the Statue of Liberty. And now the topography that's been added to it means that it has a kind of drama that it didn't before.
Do you think the South Street Seaport is a success?
Well, that's a more troubled story. And Pier 17 was not successful. I'm worried about some of the development that's going on there.
And then we lost the Fulton Street Fish Market, moved to the Bronx. What's been done with all of that area?
Well, that's in development. It's a heavily touristed area now. It was before, but even more so now. I think there it's where you see preservation, because some of those 19th century buildings have been preserved, acting as a kind of museumification of the city. And that's a theme in the book, this sense that preservation is great, and I'm a big preservation advocate, but I think we have to be aware that sometimes when you preserve things, you also kind of can squeeze the life out of it.
Could Governor's Island also have become residential?
It couldn't actually by the terms with which it was given to the city by the federal government. It can't be permanent residential. You can build a hotel there, but you can't have people living there.
Has the new Brooklyn Bridge Park lived up to its potential?
I think it's very successful. It's sort of contested because it's a place where people from large parts of Brooklyn come, and they kind of divide it up almost in a sort of tacit timeshare arrangement. It's limited by two things. One is its narrowness, because it's hugging the water and it's sort of pushed up against the BQE on one side. And the other is by the mechanism for development involved allowing developers to put buildings there. And so, you know, it could never be just a park that the city was going to build from scratch. And so, you know, we had to give up some of the land.
Weirder development is Red Hook, which has been upscale, but also still remains a residential area. It's the home of IKEA and Fairway and some fabulous restaurants, but also some buildings that look like they're falling apart and cobblestone streets.
Yeah, you know, you get, and I think it's a wonderful thing about New York, that you get these neighborhoods that are in transition, and they stay in transition and sort of unstable in their identities for a long time. Red Hook is also very vulnerable to sea level rise and to floods, as we saw in Sandy. It got damaged very heavily.
It has no public transportation to speak of.
And it has no public transportation.
Then there's the whole matter of the Domino Sugar Factory, the late lamented. They had a major show before it finally closed down. What's going to go there?
Yeah, the show I think you're referring to is Carol Walker's Subtlety, which is, I have a section in the book about that, because I found that an incredibly moving and magical experience to go into this building that was going to stop existing. They were going to tear it down. And yet you still had this sensual carryover from the past. I mean, it literally smelled of the sugar that was stored there, and the sculpture was made partly with sugar. And it was this amazing reference to the past and harbinger of the future. And it's being redeveloped as a combination of residential and office buildings and park and stores. We're told that the stores won't be the big chain stores, but will be small enough to be neighborhood stores. We'll see how that works out. But, you know, that's the kind of thing, it's very important to get that right. And I hope it will be. It's so complex that, you know, the dangers are always there.
What about the World Trade Center, which you also write about? Do you think that's been done well? The memorial, the museum, the way tourists are attracted to it, even though they have no idea what they're seeing?
you know, if you compare it to, if you have this feeling of what it could have been if you were there at the time it was being planned, then I think, you know, almost everybody who looks at it has a certain level of regret for the level of aspiration, of both architectural and urban aspiration, that it represented, and the feeling that what came out was a whole set of compromises. But you never get from an idea to reality without a whole set of compromises.
Well, weren't the towers themselves a set of compromises? I remember that area as a thriving commercial center before everything was knocked down to build the two towers, and streets were closed off.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as nostalgic as you may be for the Twin Towers, if you remember actually being there and certainly being at the foot of them, it was terrible urbanism. I mean, it was a terrible way to construct a city. It's much better to be walking around there now than it was then.
How can we preserve mom and pop retail without regulating commercial rents?
That's very difficult to do. I mean, there's...
We even wind up with the Union Square Cafe being forced to move because the rents just went up too high. And that was a successful restaurant.
And it is, again, Union Square Cafe moved into a larger location nearby. I think it's doing just fine. I'm not shedding any tears for Danny Meyer for Union Square Cafe.
But I'm making another kind of point. He can make that move. Others just have to close up shop.
You know, I think that that's true. And the financial pressures on people in New York and all over New York are really intense. But we have to remember that it's a big city. When one area changes, another one changes too, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. I think that this is a city full of unintended consequences. And, you know, you press a button in one area and there's all kinds of ripples that go out into the rest of the city. And sometimes that means that other neighborhoods change for the better for the people who live there, not just for the people who move in.
We have this constant argument over the positive and negative effects of gentrification.
Well, you know, this is an argument that has been going on since at least the 18th century. I mean, there's really nothing new. One of the things I learned about the book was kind of moving in a way, was that people always argue about what New York used to be and what it's becoming. It's always this place where nostalgia and optimism are in this constant struggle for survival. And I think that struggle is really what shaped New York more than any one direction.
And you write about the difference between the real New York and New York in quotation marks. How can we preserve authentic neighborhoods without turning them into theme parks?
I think authenticity is always one of those things that people argue about. And what constitutes an authentic neighborhood really depends on what your starting point is. If you're looking at what it's been in the last 20, 30 years, and it's been, you know, a neighborhood where, I mean, Washington Square is a perfect example. If you look at the level of affluence that's in the Village now, and you compare it to kind of the somewhat run-down, mixed neighborhood that Jane Jacobs talked about in the late 60s, it seems like a complete transformation. If you look back farther to the Washington Square of Henry James' time, in which he describes it as, you know, the new gentility, the place which really captured the soul of New York society, then you feel like it's come full circle.
And we're seeing something similar happen in areas that you don't write about, like Bed-Stuy in Harlem, where these fabulous old buildings were then broken up into five apartments. Single-family homes are broken up into five or six apartments, and now are being returned to single-family homes.
Yes. I mean, some areas of the city get denser and others get de-densified. But, you know, I think that some of this is happening in other successful cities. And what we see on the ground, the sort of block by block iteration of what's really a global phenomenon.
I'm speaking with Justin Davidson, who's critic at New York Magazine, has written a book called Magnetic City, A Walking Companion to New York, published by Spiegel & Grau. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm going to jump ahead for a moment to the Grand Concourse, which you cover in your Sugar Hill and the Bronx tour. Is that coming? But that was once a considered a grand location that went into decline. Is that coming back?
I think it's coming back. It's certainly not the crime-ridden. I mean, there's still a relatively high crime there, but it's not the really catastrophic area that, say, Tom Wolfe described in Bonfire of the Vanities in the late 80s. You know, I've been there a number of times, and it's lively and comfortable, and you know, it's a wonderful place to be. It's still a struggling neighborhood. You know, I don't want to minimize the problems with, you know, with poverty and with health issues. You know, those are all still there.
What do you think about getting back to the World Trade Center area, Santiago Calatrava's controversial Oculus, which has come under heavy criticism because of its $4 billion price tag? Do you think it's worth the money?
Well, you know, I think that it's time to kind of separate the question of whether it was worth the money from what it is now, because we're no longer making those decisions. Obviously, it was a product of some bad decision making on the part of the Port Authority. It's part of a much larger picture of bad decision making. Obviously, the Port Authority is, you know, an agency that's not quite up to dealing with our infrastructure problems, and we're seeing that in many different ways.
LaGuardia, especially.
Yes, I mean we have the issue of connectivity and transit and infrastructure. I mean, that's a hugely complicated one, and of which that is a big part. But I do think that the result is really quite inspiring. It's not like any other place in New York, and I really love the drama of the building.
Now, you have a walking tour of West Chelsea and the High Line, and it got me thinking about Soho, because West Chelsea is to some degree what Soho was 30 or 40 years ago.
In a way, by the time the art galleries started arriving in West Chelsea, the artists were long gone. So I think there was sort of more of a
from
of
Soho.
A spread.
Well, they had been moved out because rents went up. But aren't we seeing the same sort of thing happening now in
right.
Chelsea?
Right. No, actually, I meant in Chelsea. I mean, but the I think the pace was sort of different. You know, artists come in, the galleries follow, and then, you know, the galleries lead a whole kind of boutiqueification. But, you know, that whole area is also complicated. When you look at the effort to preserve the High Line and then to create the Gansevoort Historic District, that's a good example of trying to preserve something meaningful and authentic about the city, and that effort winds up changing the city too.
You've included a tour of 42nd Street, but just from Bryant Park to the UN, east of 6th Avenue, the area that includes the New York Public Library, Grand Central Terminal, the Chrysler Building, and the UN, but why did you leave out the area west of Bryant Park, the Theater District, and all those great old theaters?
Because I wanted to tell a specific story about 42nd Street, which is something different than I think what we've heard before. We tend to think of it as the theater district and also sort of its history of sordidness and crime, 42nd Street, you know, of yore. And, you know, we've heard a lot about the redevelopment of Times Square over the years. But from Bryant Park to the UN, it's almost like it has a different identity, which is, to me, it represents the ultimate civic aspirations, the idea that people and the architecture they produce can do almost unlimited good in the world. So if you look at almost any one of those large buildings, they represent kind of the ultimate of a dreamer vision of the city. So the UN was, you know, about solving war and hunger and doing that through diplomacy rather than conflict.
And Grand Central has been spared the fate of Penn Station.
Well, and Grand Central was, you know, at the time it was built and for years afterwards, the endpoint of a nationwide web of rail travel. So it really was the place from which the opening up of the entire nation, you know, began and ended. And the idea that travel should have that kind of grandeur, the public library too, the idea that you can, that anybody can walk into a building of that sort of imperial magnitude and just read a book, is kind of inspiring.
We don't have time to get into the Upper West Side, but that's an area that's changing as well. It used to be seen as the area of liberal intellectuals, probably because of its proximity to Columbia. Now, a really hot residential area, perhaps because of Lincoln Center and some other things. In between your tours, you include interludes, meditations on the city streets, skyscrapers, and apartments. Are these all features that set New York apart from other cities, the fact that there are so many apartments rather than single-family homes?
Yes. New York really had to, Manhattan especially, always had to develop vertically, as we know. And so the apartment, the development of the apartment as a standard way of living, as the default way of living in a way, was really a distinctive thing about New York and guided its whole development and continues to. Those pencil buildings you were talking about are residential buildings, and they exist because the richest people in the world who can live anywhere still want to live in a New York apartment.
Or at least buy one.
Or at least buy
if
one.
They,
yes.
Even if they don't
and leave it empty.
Live there. It's also a city, New York, where sometimes it's faster to walk than to drive. And
almost that, always.
And that would makes it almost unique among American cities. Maybe Chicago, a few others, Boston.
Well, of course, it depends, you know, how much of the city you want to cross. But I think what really makes it unique is the variety of ways there are of getting around and the way every trip from point A to point B involves a set of calculations about what's the fastest way, but also what's the most pleasant way. And even if you're just walking from point A to point B, there are always dozens of different choices you can make to get there. That's really unique.
The preferred building materials have also changed. The city used to be mainly stone and brick. Most of the new buildings are steel and glass. How has that changed the overall look of the city, and do you think it's had a psychological effect?
Yes, because New York, so much of the New York experience is about being in public, in a public place. And usually those are streets and sidewalks and the places that open up, the squares, the parks. And I think it's very difficult to create good public space when the buildings around that is when the buildings around that are made of glass. And we're going to see that at Hudson Yards, where there's a very large public space completely surrounded by glass buildings. That's going to be a tough one.
Justin Davidson's latest book is Magnetic City, A Walking Companion to New York, published by Spiegel & Grau. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.